Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest in studio, taking time from his valuable schedule, is Tony Alvarez. Tony is the owner of Evergreen Properties. He buys and sells. He buys and holds. He manages his own properties. And obviously, he's become one of the most sought-after speakers and trainers. So, Tony, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
A lot of fun. What part of your schedule now is taken up with training or teaching or, you know, speaking in front of clubs?
You know, I really haven't been doing a lot of that because there was a moment in time there where I realized it actually became a bit of a distraction, to be honest, and I wasn't focusing on my core business. So I took some time off, kind of pulled back a little bit, and reevaluated how my time should be spent. And refocused it on my own acquisitions and revamping my own management. You know, a lot of things go sideways when you put your attention on something else like that. And as you know, teaching takes focus and it takes a lot of your attention. So,
and not just the getting up in front, but creating of material.
No, yeah, and then to be honest too, the follow up. You know, because there's always, you know, you teach a class and stuff, and then there's students that come back and want more and want more and want more. I'm the type that likes to go, I do the teaching and stuff like that, and then I feel kind of obligated to stick with them and explain everything to the last minute detail. So, yeah, but right now I'd say probably 0% is being dedicated, in all honesty, to teaching, and probably 100% is being dedicated to acquisitions. As a matter of fact, our acquisition shifted into high gear now.
Okay. And, 2012, let's talk about that. Yeah. That was probably split between some training and some gradual, you know, getting back to the property buying. So what was typically your deal source for 2012, would you say?
It was primarily real estate agents still.
Okay.
And going back to when you when you spoke, and I always forget, you know, the class that you do, I wait for that class, actually. When you have that, I forget what you called it the last time, where you showed a diagram that showed what was happening to the deals, and you showed that 40% basically were, 40% of the transactions were falling apart.
Oh,
and, yeah.
Yeah,
you know, and so I zeroed in on that, and that was a couple of years ago now, mm-hmm. You know, and so I designed a whole marketing kind of program going after agents. You know, it wasn't so much deals. Again, it's about agents and asking them to please consider us. And that marketing campaign kind of included, detailing a specific property that they had pending and then saying, reminding them that, I know it's pending and stuff like that, but I also know that in our area, it was more than 50% of the deals that were falling apart, 1 to 3 times. So there could be potentially a property that was pending that would then would fall apart over the course of 12 months. You know, it'd just be falling out. It would take a couple of months and then fall out, another couple of months fall out. By the end, these agents were totally frustrated, you know.
Well, especially in your area, it's not like the commission checks are big bucks.
No, exactly.
So, gee, many Christmas. You get through the ringer for a grand every time.
Well, you just mentioned Christmas. I even added a special Christmas advertising thing where I put it in there and say, we can save your Christmas money. You know, if your deal falls apart, we'll close it by the end of the year and that kind of thing. And so we really... And we did it, and I did it with humor and stuff like that. So a lot of the agents were responding, and they still do. We just got a call today. Okay. Now, this is an interesting one.
Okay.
I got a call today. My assistant, Sabrina, who I've trained now to be also an acquisitions person, she calls me and she goes, Are you near your computer? And I try to stay away from that as much as possible. You know, I said, no, I'm not. She goes, well, can you please go over there right away? So I run over to the computer. She goes, punch in this address on Google. I don't understand half of this stuff, how it happens. But I said, you just want me to go to Google and put in an address? She goes, yes. So you put in the address and don't forget the city in California and all that. So it pops up and sure enough, there's this house for sale. She goes, go to this house. Click on it. So I clicked on it and here's his perfectly completely restored house, probably 1950s built, but completely rehabbed out there where they're big on desert landscaping and all this. And I'm looking at it, And just before I could even get the words out, she says, "That's right, it's owned by the city."
Hmm.
I said, "So why am I looking at this?" Because typically, let's say a house that has a market value of $100,000, the city will have it listed for $165,000, $170,000. Yeah, I'm not kidding you.
Okay.
This is what they do.
All right.
She goes, "Yes. The agent called me today. They've been sitting on this for over a year, and they just had somebody break in the back and cause some damage. They're looking to sell it today." I said, "What do we got to do?" Because, you know, I'm thinking, my mind's going with the price, this and that. She goes, "They're going to drop it to $65,000, and they want somebody today to bite on this. They want it locked up." I said, "Well, I don't want to pay $65,000 for this house, you know, even though I know I can sell it after I break the window for $100,000, you know."
Mm-hmm.
She goes, "Well, we're just going to have the agent make an offer, but are you on board with this?" I said, "Yeah, well, absolutely." She goes, "Good, because I already made the offer." So now that's the kind of stuff that we get. We're getting calls from an agent where something shifts. Of course, what's the next thing I'm doing is I had her contact the city and say, "What else you got?" You know,
absolutely.
Yeah. So, and they have a lot. I mean, I know that. So that's, you know, I've focused my attention on getting those leads from agents, the deals that fall apart, and that's been enough in our market.
The REO mentor.
Yes.
Is the REO agent have they translated their abilities to the short sale world?
Yes, absolutely. The conversation, they still, in many cases, identify themselves. You know, there's one guy that'll identify in the office himself as the REO guy.
Mm-hmm.
But all his understaff that he was also, they all became REO specialists at one time with their new cards. Now the card says, you know, short sale specialist or what have you. So, no, and we do, I mean, I no longer look at the source of whether it's an REO. And I don't think, you know, in all honesty, you know, I call myself the REO mentor and all this stuff, but I never really looked at it as REO. I always looked at the agent.
Right.
I'm
whatever,
looking. Yes.
Whatever the
I don't
is.
Care if he gets it from his family. You know, and my thing is I want the guy who understands me, understands what I'm trying to accomplish, and then makes the deal happen. I want somebody who can help me to accomplish that close.
But usually the agent that ends up helping you is a repetitive source for a long time.
Right.
And you even want them to have those niches. You would want the agent to be the REO agent or the short sale agent or the probate agent.
Right.
To where they always have those motivated sellers that are not just after my only home in the world for sale house.
Right.
But have these niches of as-is properties that makes perfect sense to get out of.
Yeah, no, and that's very true. And but you also have to understand that, you know, I identified long ago that there's a very small group of agents that handle all these different distress situations. And they all, you know, in markets like, especially like probably like Riverside, you have agents that, like you said, they do mostly probate or this or that, the other thing. Some of them do it all across the board, depending on the time of the market,
mm-hmm.
right? Or some of them specialize in one more than the other, but they also know each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a really important thing. And you know, oddly enough, people think there's a lot of competition between them. The real pros that have been around for a long time, I don't think experience that feeling, even when they're starving. To be honest, what I think they try to do is cooperate more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this year I got calls from a couple of agents that say that, you know, "Hey, Tony, so-and-so recommended you, and so I'm calling you out because in case you have something to sell." These were some of the agents that were representing some of these larger equity funds and stuff like that. Now they're looking to bulk buy,
right.
And they were looking with tenants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I wasted their time as long as I could and sold them nothing. But that's another conversation. I have no complaints in the acquisitions part. I still swear by my relationships with agents. You know, I suppose I'll find other ways too. Like you introduced me. You were actually the one who introduced me to marketing at a certain point in the market, you know, in the real estate cycle, going after deals from absentee owners.
Right.
And those, I have to be very frank about this. In my career, those have been the most profitable deals, besides commercial investing, but those were the most profitable deals I've ever had in my whole career that came directly from an owner seller.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we are also looking at doing some of that. We're structuring it now. We're really small office with not a lot of people. So there's only now we're down to actually 2.5 people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to figure out a way to do that to where I don't bring it into my office as much.
Are you the half of that 2.5?
Yeah, actually I am.
Okay.
There's Dana, my girlfriend. Okay. She works with us and handles all the bookkeeping stuff and a lot of the computer stuff. And then Sabrina actually manages all of the properties we have, okay? And she handles, she's learning and helping me with acquisitions. As a matter of fact, today, when she gave me that phone call, she had two court dates that she had to appear to. One was where we actually sued a tenant in small claims for a back rent or whatever. And we also had one eviction going on another. By the way, this has been my highest eviction year in probably 2 decades.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
That's because you got away from Section 8 tenants?
Not necessarily, because half of the two evictions that I've had this year,
yes,
was a Section 8 tenant.
Okay. They weren't paying their share.
They weren't. They had a problem with Section 8.
Okay.
And they were going back and forth a little bit, and Section 8, I think, was trying to drop their portion and get them to pay more or what have you. In the middle, we got, you know, she wasn't paying us. And we said, listen, we seriously hold your feet to the fire on your end of the deal, you know. She was one of them.
The hedge fund buyers.
Yes.
How has that affected not the price market but the rent market in Lancaster?
I think we have an overabundance of rentals right now. Luckily, they do a terrible job at managing their real estate. So you see, I physically drive through some of the neighborhoods and I see for rent, for rent, for rent, for rent. But the houses, I would love to record, which I've done, you know, in the past. I'd love to set up a camera in my office and record these people who come in to interview to rent from us.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say, listen, we love your house. Even though it's older than the house that we're seeing a lot of newer homes, but the condition is unbelievably atrocious.
Hmm.
So they're not managing that side real well, probably just because it's so huge, they have so much inventory. But that's affected our rents. You know, our rents, Orange County, I think, has experienced an increase in rentals. At least that's what I read in all the articles I see.
Right.
I haven't seen any articles about rental increases in the Antelope Valley since 2008. You know, so. Yeah, it's been anything. If it's anything, it's declined.
Well, part of that would be the pricing structure, and a 3.25% interest rate would certainly
probably
make ownership a lot cheaper than rent.
Yeah, our rents have gone down. The typical rent that we were getting probably $1,195, $1,200 for. Today, I'd probably be renting that house for $995.
And Section 8's reflected that as well?
Actually, Section 8 has been more dicey. In some cases, because now I'm down to, by the way, I'm down to less than 15% of my inventory is Section 8 rentals.
Okay.
Okay. But I did that because I got concerned because I saw that we were getting letters where they were reducing rents for Section 8. And this goes back about over 2 years now. Okay.
Right.
Immediately I respond to that kind of thing. And I think, okay, this is maybe their budgets are cutting back or they're looking towards the future to do some things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. We pulled back and kind of got ourselves away from that. If we're gonna, you know, if we're gonna have to charge a lower rent, I started thinking more in terms of being a lot more qualifying the tenants a little bit more hard. You know, like and you have to be careful because you can't obviously discriminate when you're renting to different people and their sources of income and stuff like that. But I became much more careful.
What's happened to the supply of homes as far as month supply in Lancaster in 12?
Yeah, I think the last time I checked was probably less than 2 months. I think we're at like a month and a half or something.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you starting to see? Well, first of all, the mix of that inventory, has it changed in type? It's gone away from REO to short sale?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. REOs are it's minimal.
Right, the smallest piece.
Yeah. We're still probably, we probably have 10 times as many REOs as everybody else does, but you're talking about 12, you know, as opposed to 1,200.
Okay.
The short sales are what definitely have increased and are increasing. And that, I think that's really the dominant part of the market. We haven't seen – we've seen some, you know, what they call standard sales or,
right.
or actual owners. But the short sales rule, absolutely.
When you drive through neighborhoods now,
yes.
is it still really obvious there was a problem where you have vacancies constantly still? You just look and go, wow, this neighborhood's really got a vacancy problem.
In our area, we do see a lot of vacant homes.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's not typical, though, I have to say, for – it's not typical, I would say, in all neighborhoods in the Antelope Valley. I think some more than others. Some of it was actually going back about 2 years ago. It was, in all honesty, the newer stuff that was more vacant.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, I think it's dropped more to some of the older houses and stuff like that. But I mean, these are homes that just they're not for rent and they're not for sale. They're just there.
Okay.
So I noticed those. Because we're always writing down address and trying to follow up and see who they belong to and stuff like that. But the number of rentals, as you asked me before, that's definitely a marked increase. And you see those signs everywhere.
Okay. How about price? You know, you got a month and a half supply of inventory. Have
right.
you started noticing any price aggression?
You know, there's been price increases. But it's not, how do I say it? You know, it's not consistent. You know, it really depends within submarkets out in the Antelope Valley. It depends what's going on within that month. And it's very inconsistent. You might have, you know, very few listings, if any. You know, you have and then you have a few. And so you might have a lot of attention for these couple of listings within this. You know, and it might be a 1950s neighborhood on the east side or something. And then the next month, you've got, you know, in the same street where the price was, you know, they got $105,000 for the sale on this house that typically would be, you know, $100,000 would be a top price or something, and they were, you know, just a couple of months before they were in the 90s. Now all of a sudden there's four or five houses for sale, and they're all short sales,
mm-hmm.
and they're all within a couple of blocks of each other, and you start to see those prices start to constrict. So, but across the board, I think we've seen some increase in pricing. Not very much because of that kind of a situation. It seems that as soon as the house goes up for sale within the neighborhood and it sells, it actually closes escrow. Immediately thereafter, we're watching this, because we're watching certain zip codes only, you see an increase in listings like within a month or so.
Okay.
And not necessarily at prices that they're going to be able to sell at. So, you know, that stuff is just silly.
Okay.
But it seems that the neighbors go, oh, well, you know, and what I think does that is that agents are out there marketing
to the owner.
And go, yeah, hey, look, we just sold this over here and mm-hmm. we can probably do this for you and all that kind of stuff. And that creates that fear. But I think that's short lived, you know.
What was the prototype house that you had in, say, 2000 to 2006? Is it the same inventory you've just rebought? And at the peak of the price in whatever it was, 07,
yeah.
What are you buying, or what are you not what are you buying it for, but what are those homes worth in relationship to the peak before? I'm really interested to know that.
Okay, well, and to the peak before, well, okay. Well, first off, at the end of the last market, I was buying, and again, on your advice, because I attended something that you were putting on, a seminar or something, and you were kind of waking us up to the fact that, hey, you guys that are fighting with each other for inventory and stuff like that, keep an eye on newer tracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look to that market as a source of inventory. Now, that was difficult for me because I never had bought new homes, but at the end of that market, I went out and bought some houses, you know, around, you know, about a year and a half to 2 years before the market peaked out.
Mm-hmm.
I bought, you know, 2,000 square foot brand new homes, custom. And they were like the developer was dying to sell those out so he can go do another tract or something. I didn't quite understand the reasons behind it, but he was explaining to me that, you know, he had to sell these out first before he can get the financing he needed on the other thing. So we ended up buying four, you know, one-story, four-bedroom, two-bath, beautiful homes, about 237, 235, I think I got a discount on some of them, you know. And then those we ended up selling upsides of $350,000, you know. I mean, it was crazy. The prices were just nuts.
Right.
And I also rented those houses out for the lot for those for that 2 year period and made a killing on the rent. I rented them to engineers from Pratt and Whitney.
So a 350 house today in that neighborhood would be what?
$200,000 tops.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've passed the 50% point,
yeah.
You would say.
Yeah, I would say they, and those houses didn't go down in that neighborhood lower than maybe 165, okay. 167.
Okay, but that's really not your prototype inventory for your rental.
No.
Okay, your rental is more 3-1 or 3-2?
3-1, 3-2. I own a lot of 1950s built stuff. The 3-1s are less than 1,100 square feet. I do own some four-bedroom, two-bath homes, if you can believe it, that are about 1,200 square feet. But, I do own some stuff built in 1980s, you know, tile roofs, that kind of stuff. But that's a smaller part of my inventory.
The inventory when you sold it was what, between 250 and 300 at the peak in 07?
Oh, no. Well, I guess we could say that, yeah. Yeah, 250 to 300, yeah. Most of the houses I sold...
You can't believe it yourself, huh?
Especially when I'm buying them back.
Well, that's
I bought some of those houses back that I sold for $280,000, $290,000. I paid $60,000, $50,000. Some of them $45,000.
And what are they worth today, you think?
Oh, they're all a little different because, you know, I mean, it's just...
Still not half of the former value, we'd say?
No, I just got somebody made me an offer on a house for $125,000. That's a, you know, 1,200 square foot, 3 plus 2. No, not even 1,200, but 1,100 square feet, newer home, you know, built. Well, when I say newer, it was built 1990s with tile roof and stuff like that. I paid $60,000 for that house in 08.
Yeah.
And I told him no. I said, you know, I did my little chart and stuff and I said, did you just attended Bruce Norris's seminar? I'm not selling this yet.
Anybody building anything out here?
No.
Okay.
No. The city's the only one that actually even tried to develop some, you know, lots that weren't finished and stuff like that. But that's been a disaster.
Okay.
You know, really, they've lost tons of money.
Okay. Well, you know, it really sounds like that there's... I think there's a real healthy price increase of, you know, for most areas, but your area really hasn't taken off yet.
Right.
And not enough to anybody. They can't really construct stuff. That was so similar. Matter of fact, when you and I met, that's one of the things that was a stark difference is that you were coming to me saying you're about to exit that inventory.
Right.
And I was looking at my set of charts saying I haven't even started to build yet and I'm 9 miles away, you know, because I was looking at... It's not time to build yet, and you're trying to, you're almost exiting. So we're almost in that same situation where it doesn't pencil to build, so it sure as heck isn't time to sell stuff. I mean, this is going to get aggressively up before these guys start building and certainly before they start creating building lots.
Oh, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, I was going to sell this year. Honestly, I was. I was considering selling. And...
Not because you thought it was a peak, just because you're getting, lazy.
I'm lazy. You know, I've always been lazy, but I'm getting a little lazier. You know, I'm 57 now. Not that that's really, really old or anything, but, you know, I got a beautiful home up in Smith River and stuff. And I, you know, do I really need to do anything else? I really don't. I live a very frugal life. I'm, you know, so sometimes I get up in the morning and the last thing I want to do is buy another house. And much like today, like what happened today, you know, I was literally in sweatsuits with no shoes and socks on, walking around my tile floor, very comfortable, having a cup of this stuff that's pretend a coffee and, you know, and I was enjoying myself. And the phone rings, and there's Sabrina trying to get me to buy another house, you know.
How good of a negotiator does that make you? You know, it's like, do I have to have it at 60, 65?
Yeah, no, it's very true. I know, and that is very true. You know, where I immediately she said, you know, I'm going to the city today after I get out of court, you know. And I said, yeah, have at it. You know, I couldn't get even worked up about the thought of going down there and talking, even though I'm friends with those people, you know. But,
Tony, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun, of course, and if you get a chance to hear Tony speak, please do it.
Thank you, Bruce.
You betcha.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.